For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, we're all at sea. I discuss a mysterious case of people who can change into seals at the full moon with author Melanie Golding. Ellie Marsh goes behind the scenes to explore the North Water with its author Ian Maguire. And Robert Kirkwood drops in on the recording of The Shark and the Albatross with wildlife filmmaker John Aitchison. That's all coming up on today's Read On. The Replacement is the gripping new novel from Melanie Golding, the best-selling author of Little Darlings. Like her debut, The Replacement weaves a story inspired by folklore with the pace and twists of a police procedural. And it also features Selkies, mythical beings who can change into seals. Here's Melanie Golding to tell us more. Mel, welcome to Read On.
Thanks for having me.
The Replacement is the second book in which we meet Detective Sergeant Joanna Harper. And you drop her and us straight into the action.
Yeah, I do that. Do you know what? That was actually a tip I had quite early on in my writing career, that you ought to drop people straight into the action. So I'm glad that that's worked out.
It's a seemingly straightforward case that she's called to investigate. But as we have learnt to expect from you, it's a very tangled mystery. Can you just introduce us to the case?
So the book opens on midwinter, so it's the solstice in December, and there is a toddler who's seemingly been abandoned outside a shop in Cleethorpes, but then her mother turns up quite quickly and everything seems fine and they let her go, but then it turns out that it wasn't her mother, so that's sort of the opening mystery. Meanwhile, there's a man who's been found close to death in a bathtub over in Sheffield, which is a fair few miles away, but they're in the same area of Britain.
And without giving any spoilers, Jo finds that there's a closer link to home than she might otherwise have expected.
That's right. So my police officer character, Jo, discovers that her estranged family member, Ruby, who is her biological daughter, is at the heart of this case. And they haven't seen each other for a while. There's been like a family breakdown. But when she finds out that it's Ruby that's involved, it all gets quite personal for her, yes.
And Ruby takes much more of a part in this book. We met her in Little Darlings, but as you say, it's a complex relationship between Ruby and Jo. They were brought up as sisters.
Yeah, they were brought up as sisters because Ruby was a result of a, as yet undiscussed, fairly traumatic period in Jo's life when she was a teenager, and she had a baby that she wasn't quite sort of old enough to take care of. So her mother adopted Ruby into the family. It's more common in years gone by than you might think for that to happen, I would say. So I was sort of interested in how that relationship might play out.
You really do love to investigate the dark hinterland of motherhood, don't you? In Little Darlings, we saw maybe every new mother's worst nightmare, fearing that her children were under threat, and also that she wouldn't be believed, that her belief would be passed aside as hysterical postpartum depression. And here we see another side of motherhood, the difficult choices that Jo Harper has had to make in her life, the sacrifices.
Yeah, I do tend to do that. I love that phrase, the dark hinterland of motherhood. Yeah, so I do find those things really interest me. I think I'm always interested in things that are sort of presented in one way in society and then have sort of deep, perhaps secret or not quite discussed things. And motherhood's one of those things where there's a lot of darkness that people don't discuss as much. I mean, they are more now. I mean, since I wrote Little Darlings and while it was coming out, there's a fair few motherhood themed kind of horror or darker thrillers, which I was very happy to see because, yeah, it's my genre, I think.
And you blend it beautifully with urban myths and ancient folklore. Again, in this book, we are introduced to the Selkie people, those folkloric figures who are part human, part seal. Can you tell us when you first got interested in Selkies and Rhones?
I think I'm drawn to a lot of folklore, but especially to stories where I think there might be more truth in it than people might imagine. So in Little Darlings, with the postpartum psychosis, when I read the Changeling story, I just thought, well, that's about postpartum psychosis. And similarly, when I read the Selkie story, I could imagine that it was about, you know, whenever the story first originated, which is sort of impossible to tell, it was more likely to be about something real than actual shapeshifters. So I quite liked the idea that the themes in it are also extremely contemporary. I've got this theory that folk tales are part of being human and story is all to do with people, and it's all mixed up. You can't really quite put things in boxes. So I really kind of connected with the Selkie story, and I just loved it really. And then I thought, well, this could easily be a story about something that happens now. And I did meet someone who told me that she was a Selkie, that her grandmother was descended from Selkies, you know, fully straight faced, this is my family history. And I found that very interesting as well, because there are different beliefs knocking about that aren't necessarily based in science. And I really love that idea.
And the Selkie people who appear in your novels wrap themselves in seal skin and swim in the sea all night when there's a full moon.
Yeah.
And that is, well, again, without giving any spoilers, that is intrinsic to the plot of The Replacement.
Yeah, it is. I think we used to be a lot more connected to nature than we are these days. So, yeah, I think those kinds of things are very evocative, especially in novels and works of fiction.
And I believe you've done quite a deep dive into this. You've actually just completed a PhD on the influence of folklore in modern thrillers.
Yeah, I have. That's right, yeah. I just had my Viva about 6 weeks ago. Yeah, that was really interesting. So, yeah, I've probably thought too hard about it, to be fair. So it's probably quite hard for me to be snappy on the subject because I've read so many books. I'm sitting on my desk now and I've got stacks of books, both academic and novels, and they're all to do with Selkies and mermaids and folklore. The PhD was a great experience. I did it at the same university that I did my master's at Bath Spa. Not sure how useful it will be, but I'm not sure that's the point.
Might we see it published in the non-fiction shelves?
Well, the PhD, because it's a practice-based PhD, quite a lot of it is the actual novel. So like 80% of your mark is on The Replacement in this case. And then you do an accompanying thesis, which is about 20,000 words, which is published in a university library. And I talk in that thesis quite a lot about how I took the folklore and made it into this novel, but also how the publishing process transforms your ideas and how the editing process and having other people look at your work is transformational. So there's a big transformational theme to the thesis.
Which in many ways reflects the way that urban myths are passed on between people. And this is something that D.S. Harper finds is almost in conflict with the nuts and bolts policing that she is expected to do for her day-to-day job. There is something that a lot of people would just write off as superstition or hokum. So she's in constant battle with some of her colleagues to have her voice heard.
Yeah. So Jo, in my head, she lives in a world where it's possible that folklore is true. So, yeah, in both of the books, she comes across these possibilities of there being something other than what would be a standard experience. And I think I like to explore those edges of reality, because for some people, they are reality. And you have to kind of accept that there's ways of experiencing the world that are entirely different from our own.
And I think the fact that so much folklore is from an oral tradition, and yes, it is written down, but it's written down in different and sometimes conflicting ways. But really, it is repeated stories handed down through generations. It actually lends itself rather well to a police procedural, because detectives are taking snatches of overheard conversations, fractions of other people's suspicions, and having to build them into a larger story, some of which might sometimes seem rather outlandish. Is that why you were driven to write Joe as a police detective rather than a woman exploring her own suspicions?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation, actually, because, yeah, with the police detective, they are sort of obliged to look at the evidence in a kind of a cold way and include things because they're there rather than because whether or not they believe them. But when Joe Harper first appeared in Little Darlings, I wasn't necessarily intending to write a police story at all. I got sort of halfway through and I realised that I needed someone to explore this idea that Lauren was having this experience and nobody knew whether it was real or not. So I needed, for the reader's sake, to have a character that was investigating whether or not it was true. And so that's when Jo appeared in the narrative, because she was needed. She sort of walked in and said, oh, this needs investigating, which is an interesting experience, which I had heard writers talk about before and thought, oh, surely not. But yeah, she did walk in and go, I'm going to take charge of this.
Oh, well, so you hadn't actually planned her originally as part of the book?
No, I'd written half of Little Darlings and it was all Lauren's perspective. And I'd sort of hit a wall and gone, well, we need to know various things that there's no way Lauren can tell us. And that's how she turned up. Yeah.
And did she come to you fairly fully formed? Because she's quite a forceful character.
Yeah, she is quite. I think she did. Yeah. I think it came quite naturally to me to write her. And then when I went on to write The Replacement, it seemed very natural to continue exploring her character and her story. I think there's probably a lot more that actually that could be written about Jo, and especially the historical stuff that happened to her when she was younger. So there may well be room for another Jo Harper book in the future.
Oh, I think most of us are definitely hoping that there will be.
Yeah.
You certainly don't leave everything tied up at the end of this book.
Yeah.
As you've already indicated, you like to write from different points of view. Do you find it easy to slide from character to character as you write the book?
I do. This book has more points of view in it than Little Darlings does. But it had even more that were removed during the editing process. While I was writing it, I was writing things from the perspective of various objects and things like that. So I find that a lot of the process of writing a novel is telling yourself the story. And if you write a scene from the perspective of an object that's in the room, sometimes you see things that you wouldn't have seen had you been writing it from the perspective of one of your humans. But a lot of those point of view chapters never made it into the book because they were a bit too weird, I think. But yeah, I really like writing things in different perspectives.
And both books have been brought wonderfully to life as audiobooks by Stephanie Racine, who tackles all those voices with great aplomb. Did you have something to do with her selection as a narrator?
I did, yeah. Before Little Darlings, my publisher sent me various clips of different audiobook narrators, and I chose her from them. Yeah, she's great.
Leonie reaches for a bauble, a shiny thing, sparkling. There's a chocolate bell, too, and she drops the fruit bar to take it in her hand. "Whose child is this?" calls the stranger, as the man from behind the counter comes forward, rubbing his hands together, his eyes wide with concern. "Mama?" says Leonie to the shopkeeper, recognising nothing but the worry in his expression. Her bottom lip wobbles in uncertainty. Then, Her grip on the foil-covered decoration is lost, and it hits the floor tiles, smashing into pieces that scatter from the wrapping as it splits. There is stillness as she looks at all the bits in turn, her face registering surprise. This, seemingly, is the most upsetting thing. She shuts her eyes to cry, face to the ceiling, fists clenched, mouth open, revealing 8 perfect teeth.
Stephanie Racine, narrating The Replacement, written by my guest, Melanie Golding.
A lot of people like to listen to audiobooks in their cars, but I understand that you, as a busy mum, have been known to write in your car.
Yeah, well, I've sat with my laptop writing in the car, and also, yeah, when we had a house full, when I was a childminder, and I had no space, I would go and sit in the car just on the drive and write in the car. It's a good space, actually. You can move it anywhere you like, yeah.
As a busy mum and author, you must have developed that discipline for being able to produce as many words as you can do in the short times between the kids being at school and coming home or being asleep when they were younger.
Yeah, I think when your time is squeezed, is that saying, isn't there? If you want something done, give it to a busy person. Mm. And when I was writing my first novel, that it was like my practice novel that didn't and will never be published, I felt this sort of desperation to write. And I was doing what I now know is called the 5 a.m. club, which is like a big thing. But you get up at 5, you write for a couple of hours, and then you get on with all the other things you're supposed to be doing. But now I'm currently writing, like you say, while the children are at school. It's a different kind of time squeeze, but it does feel like luxury compared to that.
And you've hinted at it. Is there another Joe Harper novel on the way, or are you giving her a rest and writing something else?
Well, I'd love to write another Joe Harper because there's so much more that she can do, you know, and there's so much more like issues that I'd love to explore using her as a kind of a conduit. So yeah, I guess it's watch this space. I'll definitely be writing something a bit folklory. As to whether the character is the immediate next thing, I couldn't tell you, it's a secret.
I suppose it also depends on whether she walks into the action herself or decides to give this one a miss.
That's right. Yeah, she does do that. And it's difficult to predict what she's going to do. Yeah.
Well, Melanie Golding, thank you so much for coming onto the show and introducing us to D.S. Joe Harper and her strange folkloric case history.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Thanks to publisher HarperCollins, both The Replacement and Little Darlings are available from the RNIB library.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss. Or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Robert Kirkwood takes a closer look at nature through the lens of wildlife documentary maker John Aitchison. But first, and maintaining the maritime theme, Ian McGuire's gritty historical novel, The North Water, is a murder story set aboard a Victorian whaling ship whose home port is Hull. It's recently been adapted into a successful BBC series, starring acclaimed actors Jack O'Connell, Colin Farrell and Stephen Graham. Our resident Yorkshire lass, Ellie Marsh, was keen to discover more about the novel and its creation.
Hello, Ian McGuire, and welcome to Read On.
Hi, Ellie. Thanks for inviting me on.
So, for anybody who hasn't been aboard The Volunteer, can you give us a little bit of a synopsis about what The North Water is and what it's about?
Yeah, I mean, The North Water, yeah, The Volunteer is the name of a fictional whaling vessel. So it's set largely on a whaling voyage from Hull to Greenland, to Baffin Bay, which is the waters just to the west of Greenland. And it's in the mid-19th century, so the novel takes place in 1859. And we begin in Hull as the voyage is starting, and then most of the novel follows the voyage, which turns out not to be straightforward, mainly because, as we learn in chapter one, there's a man named Henry Drax who is on board, who proves to be, well, he is a murderer and a nasty piece of work in general. So he creates all kinds of mayhem, which unfold as the voyage goes forward.
We will talk about Henry Drax in a little while. But first, the life of a Yorkshire whaler, the life aboard a Yorkshire whaler, was not easy, to say the least. How much did you know about the lives of these men before you set out writing the book? And why did you choose to set the story aboard a whaling ship?
It was a strange and sort of violent and dirty sort of business, the Arctic whaling. I knew very little, actually. I guess what I knew about whaling before I started thinking about the North Water, I got almost entirely from reading Moby Dick, from Herman Melville's book about whaling. But once I started sort of researching the history of British Arctic whaling, I realized that although the basic intentions were the same, they went out to kill as many whales as possible, that the industries were very different, because the American whaling was mainly took place in the Pacific, where the climate was rather warm and pleasant most of the time. The dangers were dangers of typhoons occasionally, but that was it. Whereas Arctic whaling was all about the ice and the massive dangers of this huge amount of thick, sort of rock-hard ice, which put the ships in peril. Even though the voyages took place in the summer, even in those days before any kind of climate change, there was a lot of ice around, even in the summer months. That was the major difference. So I realized I had to do quite a bit of research to sort of figure out, to learn more about the specifics of Greenland whaling or Arctic whaling. So that took a little while. I had to read accounts of the whaling trade and historical accounts. So it took a little while to sort of to figure out what it was like.
And it's just brutal, basically.
Yeah, I mean, a whaling ship was really, they were hunting, but then they had to butcher the whale. So one way of thinking about a whaling ship is kind of a 300-ton sort of moving abattoir, really, in which these enormous creatures are killed, then sort of chopped up and stowed away. So it was a very hard life from our perspective, sort of unimaginable, really. All these men cramped together in these very difficult conditions, doing this very bloody work.
You can just imagine the smells and everything that they would have experienced. Just,
yeah, I think that's right. They had to store the blubber under the ships. And if they were successful, then the ship would be full of blubber and full of whale bone. And the whole process of that, of course, blood and grease and oil everywhere. So it was a pretty gruesome business all in all.
And you yourself are from Hull. It's not too far. I'm from Leeds, so it's not too far from where I call home. But when you set out writing this book, did it have anything to do with the fact that you were from Hull? And did you want to set a book? I mean, we don't spend a lot of time in Hull, but it's always mentioned throughout the story, and it's a big part of the story. Was that intentional for you as a person from Hull?
It was more a happy coincidence, really. I came up with the idea of having a novel with a murderer on a whaling ship when I stumbled across a diary that was kept by Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes author, when he was a medical student working as a surgeon on a Dundee whaling ship, which gave me the idea of setting some kind of crime story on a whaling ship. And that was kind of the germ of the North Water. So that was where it started. And then the fact that I could set it in Hull, was it felt like a nice coincidence. I liked the idea that the novel could sort of begin in Hull. It felt like that gave me a bit of confidence in writing it, because it was a kind of departure for me. It was very different from anything I'd written before. So it was nice to have a sort of sense, okay, well, I'm from Hull, so maybe even though it was 100 years in the past, I have some kind of connection that can get me into the story.
When Black finds Sumner, he looks dead already. His body is wedged into the narrow crack between two ice floes. His head and shoulders are above the water, but everything else is below. His face is bone white, apart from the lips, which are a dark, unnatural blue. Is he even breathing? Black leans down to check, but he can't tell. The wind is too loud, and all around the ice is screeching and grating in the swell. Everything about the surgeon appears frozen up and solid. Black takes his sealing rope and secures it around Sumner's chest. He doubts that he can pull him out on his own, but he tries anyway. He yanks him sideways first to dislodge him from the crevice. Then, setting his heels in the snow, hauls upwards with all his might. Sumner's stiff and motionless body rises with remarkable ease, as though the sea has decided it doesn't want him after all.
So our characters, we've spoken about Henry Drax, and we've mentioned a surgeon. The surgeon is Richard Sumner, and they're on this boat together. We've mentioned that Henry Drax is, you know, a murderer and a horrible person character. The distinction for me, I kind of thought that they were almost opposites of each other. So Drax does all these horrendous, awful things and has no remorse for anything that he's done in his past, doesn't feel any guilt, whereas Sumner is almost still consumed by his past and by the guilt that we learn about through the book. And I'm guessing that's quite deliberate to show the two sides of how a human can react when put in extreme circumstances, or how they can react to trauma.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yes, that is a big crucial part of the difference between them, that Drax is a kind of person who doesn't worry about anything he's done and doesn't worry about the future. He just lives in the kind of moment and does what he wants to do in the moment. And he doesn't have any kind of backstory in the novel as well. So I don't explain where he comes from or why he's like that. He just sort of appears in the novel in this way, in this kind of inexplicable sense. Whereas, as you say, Sumner is a man who has this long backstory, which explains where he is. But he's had a difficult childhood and then has tried to make his way as a surgeon in the army. But during the siege of Delhi, things have gone very wrong for him, and he's been discharged from the army in disgrace, and that's what's hanging over him as he's on the Volunteer. He really wants to just escape from life and try and escape from his past. So that consumes him, whereas Drax is a man who has no such worries. So you're absolutely right, that's a crucial difference between them, really.
When you're writing these two characters, what's your process of creating a character and getting inside a character's head to be able to write about them?
Well, for Drax, the one thing which I started with and which carried me through the novel, really, was the idea of a Drax as an animal, not just in a kind of sense of, you know, sometimes you say, oh, he's an animal in a kind of an insulting way, but in a rather more literal sense, that the way he moves through the world is like a sort of dog or a wolf moves through the world, in a sense of just not having any conscience or worrying about what's just happened to him, just seeing what's in front of him. And if he doesn't like it, he kills it. Or if he likes it, he takes it in some sense. And then he just moves on to the next thing. So that was the key for me to Drax's character, really, which is partly why the novel is full of sort of smells and scents, because I thought of him as this animal sort of sniffing and snuffling his way through the world. And though it's quite a simple idea, for Drax, that carried him through. And then I think for Sumner, it was really about a man who's haunted by his past. And also, I suppose, a man who's from a humble background and has tried all through his life to overcome that and seems to have failed. So he's a man who's dogged by this sense of failure and disgrace. And the question for him, I suppose, is always, is it possible to escape from that? Is it possible to sort of shrug off, as you say, this kind of trauma and start again? So for me, those were the two kind of key features of their characters, which, as I was writing it, it's useful to have a sort of sense of what's the nub of the characters. That so if you get a little bit lost, as you often do in a novel, you can always go back to that and remind yourself that's what makes them tick.
What was it like to spend so much time in your own mind with Henry Drax? Because for me, he's terrifying. And I can't imagine, you know, sitting on your own and writing the book and being in his mind. What was that like?
Yeah, people have asked me variations of that question a few times. I mean, I think one of the odd things is that the experience of writing is very different from the experience of reading, I think. So when I'm writing, or when I was writing a character like that, I was kind of not so conscious of his awfulness in that sense. It's much more technically, can I make this character work? Can I move him through this scene in the way I want him to? So there's more of a technical, mechanical sense of trying to get each scene in which he functions to work properly. So that gives you quite a lot of distance, I think, on the kind of moral side of his character. And it's only when you step back from that and read the novel later, or more often hear from readers what the experience was like, that you realize what it's like just to come at him as a reader rather than someone who's been trying to figure him out from the inside, as it were.
That's quite an interesting parallel, the fact that you've got a different take on a character that you've written from somebody who's read it.
Definitely, I think. Definitely, yeah. And sometimes it's surprising when readers sort of say, notice something or say, oh, that isn't that, wasn't that a horrible moment? And you go, oh, yeah, I suppose it was, but...
I just wanted to ask as well, polar bears feature throughout the whole book, from the beginning, the middle, the end, they always seem to be present in some form. What did you want the polar bears to represent and why did you choose the bear to do that?
The polar bear became a more and more important sort of symbol as the novel continued. One thing I wanted the polar bear to do was to give another version of animality, because I thought it's slightly, I call Drax an animal and think Drax of Drax an animal, but in some sense that's quite unfair to animals. So I wanted to have another version of animality, which suggested a whole different set of possibilities. So that's really where the polar bear came in. And I think I definitely figured the polar bear out as I was working through the novel. I didn't at the beginning sort of realize or think that the bears would be so important as they turned out to be. I suppose in the end, I wanted the polar bear to sort of hint at a different way of thinking about animals, more a kind of way that sort of hunter gatherers like the Inuit, who appear later on in the novel, think of animals as not something below human beings, but actually as something sort of higher than human beings, as a way of sort of connecting to some sort of larger, more eternal sort of realm. So I wanted the bear to sort of hint at that possibility. And that's why the bear pops up in different guises.
At points through the book as well, the Humidor Sumner in particular is almost inferior to the bear. The bears in their own environment, they know how to survive, and Sumner less so. I just wanted to ask about whether you thought that represents sort of the survival of the human spirit and the fact that at some points he is really losing the will to live, especially when he's chasing the bear. So what does that say to you about the will of the human spirit and the will to survive?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably the scene in which that's clearest is the scene towards, I guess, sort of two thirds or three quarters of the way through, where he has this solo hunt for the bear, and it kind of clear sort of at a certain point that he's gone too far. You know, he's left the camp behind and he's no way he's going to get back. So he's at this kind of this point where he's completely alone, and there's just him and this bear. So it is a kind of confrontation with nature, I suppose, and kind of he has nothing else to rely on. As you say, there's just him and this in this kind of Arctic wasteland and a bear. But without giving away too much, I suppose in the end that the bear enables him to live. So the bear kind of gives him a way of sort of surviving and being reborn on some level. So there is it's a kind of interesting moment where these two, the animal and the human, sort of merge, I suppose.
It's really striking imagery as well in your mind, yeah. I just wanted to touch on, obviously, the success of The North Water and the fact that it has been made recently into a TV series for the BBC. Have you watched it?
I have, several times.
What did you think?
I loved it, yeah. I mean, the first time it was just strange because a lot of the dialogue is taken fairly directly from the novel, so it was odd to see these great actors sort of saying the words that I'd written on my own in my little room in Manchester. So the first time that was just odd. Then the second time I could see it a bit more objectively. I think they did a great job. I mean, it's obviously an interpretation of the novel, as any adaptation is. And there are a few things changed or missed out. But I thought overall, I thought they did a fantastic job. And the director, Andrew Haig, and the actors were really, really good.
Yeah, I think it's a really good series. I was going to ask you about the lines from the film, from the series, because they are literally just taken straight out of the book. What was that like watching that for the first time and knowing that you wrote those lines? It must be a bit weird.
It was. I went with my wife to the set. Well, I think all of the interior scenes were shot on a stage, sound stage in Budapest. So we went out there and I saw a couple of scenes, one with Stephen Graham and Tom Courtney and another with Colin Farrell. Yeah, it was a kind of slightly surreal moment when these kind of fantastic actors sort of popped up and started saying these words. So it's a strange feeling when it first happens, but very kind of great, obviously, and wonderful and it's fascinating to see what they do with those lines, obviously, because it's interpreted by the actor as well. I mean, those lines could be said in various ways.
Absolutely. And the audiobook is read fantastically by John Keating. With all the different characters, like you say, interpreting the words and, you know, bringing different characters to the written text. Did you have much input on the production of the audiobook?
I didn't know. I think what they asked me is whether I'm okay with the person reading. So yeah, they sent me a sample of other books that he'd done, and he sounded great. So I just said, yep, that sounds good to me. And then once it's done, they'll send me a copy. So I listened to a little bit of it and I thought it was good as well. So I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I really did. I think it fits the story really well, the way that he speaks and things like that. Did you not fancy reading it yourself?
It would. They didn't ask me to, so they probably don't think my voice is mellifluous enough, but it would take a long time. I think it would be a kind of exhausting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back later on in the show to talk about the books of your life, but The North Water is a brilliant book and congratulations on it. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks to Ellie Marsh and author Ian Maguire. The North Water is available from the RNIB Library, and Ian will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Ian Maguire to share the books of his life, John Aitchison is a wildlife filmmaker who's won BAFTA and Emmy Awards for his work both as a documentary producer and a wildlife cameraman. He's also documented many of his experiences in a memoir called The Shark and the Albatross. The audiobook version was recorded at the RNIB Studios in Glasgow, where Robert Kirkwood met up with him.
Through the lens, I can see her whiskers, covered in frost, and her amber eyes. She turns to look directly at me. It's the first eye contact I've had with any of the wolves.
John Aitchison reading from his book The Shark and the Albatross. In a break in the recording, he told me about the book.
Well, the book's called The Shark and the Albatross, and it's about various stories of filming wildlife all over the place. I've been a wildlife cameraman for 20 years, and it struck me that what I have to film is generally wildlife behaviour. So I might go somewhere to film a tiger and her cubs, and she's hunting to feed the cubs, and it's a story about maybe how stealthy she is and how the prey avoid her catching them. But in each of these places, there's much more to tell than just that one story which appears on the television, because in the background there are fascinating people who work there and live there and know the tigers very well, and there's a story of what the filming is like, what the experience is like behind the scenes, and also the conservation story, because in that case, for instance, the tiger's forest is surrounded by farms. The tigers don't have anywhere else to go, so the cubs most often die. They're either killed by male tigers if they stay behind, or if they go outside they tend to be killed by people or hit by trains. So those stories were, if you like, going to waste. And it seemed to me there's another level of interest in natural history beyond just pure wildlife behaviour.
The shots that inspired the title of the book, the incident with the shark and the albatross, did you know that was likely to happen, or was it an accident?
No, we went there specifically for that purpose. It had been filmed once before, and it happens every year. So there's a small island, lots of albatrosses nesting on it. They have to leave, and they haven't flown before. So their very first flight takes them out over the water. And if they're strong and have been able to practice in windy conditions on the island, if they've been able to sort of fly up and down vertically, they might get far enough away that they escape the sharks. But these tiger sharks swim maybe 1,000 miles to be at that one island for the 2 or 3 weeks when the albatrosses leave every single year, and they arrive usually on the first day that the albatrosses start flying, and no one knows how they do that. But they wait just offshore, the albatrosses try and take off, get clear of the sharks, which they don't know about, of course, and the sharks grab them if they land above them. They have some way of detecting them by electrical impulses too, I think. I don't think they just see them. And they take the albatrosses from below, drag them underwater and eat them. So I was supposed to film that from above, and there were divers there filming it from underneath as well, filming the sharks. Now, what struck me was that I sympathised with the albatrosses, which I guess is understandable, because I was looking at them all the time, and from their perspective, the sharks are a nightmare, really. They just appear from nowhere and swallow the albatrosses. Whereas the divers who were with the sharks would come up every time saying how wonderful the sharks were. They were taking great risk diving with these big sharks, but they were saying they were beautiful, and they were saying how incredible they were that they'd migrated so far. And they were saying that they're overfished and they're dying out because so many are caught each year. Meanwhile, on the islands, the albatrosses, we were finding young albatrosses choked on plastic rubbish, which they'd been fed by their parents by mistake, thinking it was food. So I chose that title for the book, The Shark and the Albatross, because it struck me that when we think about predators and prey, we might be thinking that we prefer one over the other, shark or albatross. But in fact, now, there's so many pressures on nature that we should be thinking whether we want sharks and albatrosses or neither. Because at the present, we're heading towards a state where there might be neither. We have to decide if we're on nature's side or against nature. So that book is, my book is about that partly as well.
Now, when you said there that you sympathised with the albatross, it reminded me of a documentary called Faces in the Mob about kangaroos, and one scene in particular featuring the last slow moments of a joey. Is that ever a dilemma? Would part of you want to rescue that creature, or would you rather document nature taking its course?
It's a dilemma, actually, always. Every situation is different in that respect. I mean, the simplest thing would be a predator and its prey. Unless I've somehow caused the prey to be in the path of the predator, which I would always try and avoid doing, obviously, then I feel I should have no part in that, and that the predator has to eat. They'll die, perhaps, if they don't eat the thing that they would normally eat. So that's just a watch and see, and I might have to wince and sometimes even turn away when that's happening, because sometimes it can be quite horrible. But if it's something, a young animal maybe that's suffering or that's abandoned or stuck in some way, it's fallen in a hole or it just needs to be turned over or something like that, it's just an accident, then yes, I will often help. For instance, on the Hebrides series that I made for BBC Scotland with a colleague, when we were filming the short-eared owls nesting, their chicks were exposed to bad weather because the parents had abandoned them. The father went first. He may have actually been killed by a car. We don't really know. And then the mother couldn't feed them and look after them, so she also left. And because I was filming them, I knew that they were on their own in the nest and were getting cold and wet and had no food. And the SSPCA came at my request and took them into care and reared them and then let them go again when they were adult. So, yes, I help sometimes.
What's the longest you've ever waited for a shot?
For one shot? Well, I suppose it's usually in the order of several weeks. I mean, there have been occasions, there's one in the book actually about filming lynx, where we went for a month, 4 weeks, to Canada and failed to film a sequence of lynx. I did actually film some shots of them, but on their own there were not enough shots to make the story. So although the story could have been changed into a story about snowshoe hares and a little bit about lynx, it just wasn't interesting enough like that. So that was a month without filming the useful shots that we needed.
And what about a favourite moment?
Yes, I suppose it might sound strange, but the thing I most like filming are patterns. And that can be patterns of large numbers of animals or natural patterns in the landscape. So some of my favourite things have been big flocks of birds like starlings, those amazing manoeuvres that the murmurations of starlings do just before they go into a roost. And I once filmed that with Bill Oddie, actually, for one of his programmes in Gloucestershire. And he did a very sensitive piece to camera at the same time. Somebody else was filming him talking about the starlings. And the combination, actually, the way it worked out, the combination of the starlings, we were on a slight hill, so the level was particularly good for filming them swirling. They were behind him, so I could see him reacting to them. And the other camera was filming him talking about them very beautifully. And then at the end, there's almost a perfect end to that display because they spiral down into the roost in the reed bed that they go into. And it just naturally ends. It's got a perfect theatrical end to it just at sunset. So that was a real joy filming that, actually.
And is it better filming? Is it a better job when you're comfortable rather than, say, in Frozen Planet when you're also against the elements?
Yeah, sometimes it can be quite uncomfortable sometimes if it's very cold, but I've got lots of good equipment. The coldest I've been actually wasn't in the Antarctic at all, or the Arctic. It was in the mountains in the Adirondacks in upstate New York earlier this year, because they had an exceptionally cold winter, and I was supposed to be filming pine martens from a hide. And I had 30 days in a canvas hide at minus 30, minus 35 centigrade for 8 hours sitting still. And my water bottle would freeze, and the food was all frozen. You're trying to eat frozen apples or frozen sandwiches. And the pine martens were much more sensible. They just didn't come out. I could actually have just left a thermometer there and in front of a webcam or something and gone away to the Caribbean for 3 weeks and come back, you know, after that, and it would have been fine.
Have you ever feared for your life?
Yes, sometimes, but it tends to be more people than animals, really, that are the cause sometimes. And I've never been seriously threatened. It's just sometimes the situations, you get into some strange situations sometimes which are quite remote or where it's not clear really what people's intentions are. Or on roads as well, driving in some countries, it's a bit wild. But I was nearly hit by an avalanche once, quite a small avalanche, but it would have, if I'd been 3 feet to the right, it would have probably swept me off a cliff. I had a snake in a tree. I was filming harpy eagles, which are very big, powerful eagles that live in South America. And that meant staying up in a tree for a month on a tea tray attached to a tree trunk, really, effectively, for all the daylight hours. And it was very, very windy there and stormy quite often. And during a storm with really strong winds, I looked up and there was a very large snake going through the tree next to me. And it did all the branches except the branch I was sitting on. And I realised afterwards that must have meant that it had actually been on that branch. I just didn't notice it, which meant it went over my feet, more or less.
But you keep going back, so you must love it.
Yes, I do love it. Yeah, I'm extraordinarily lucky. The shark is shocking when it comes. The sea erupts. A head 4 times wider than the bird hurls it towards the sky, its wings trailing. In this liquid world, the shark is astonishingly solid. The antithesis of water, like a blade. Its eyes are blank white circles, zombie-like membranes closed for protection as it attacks. But they mean the shark must strike blind, and it doesn't see the albatross slide sideways from its enormous head, unharmed. A triangular fin cuts past, inches away, and far taller than the bird. The tail thrashes as the shark turns to try again. The camera runs. I haven't breathed.
John, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Robert and to John Aitchison. And since that interview was recorded, The Shark and the Albatross has entered the RNIB Talking Books Library. Now it's back to Ian McGuire for the books of his life.
Is there a book from your childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could pick any number, I suppose, but the book that sort of pops into my mind is Treasure Island, the kind of classic boys' adventure book, which I first read it on one of those Ladybird editions, you know, the kind of simplified for early readers with lovely illustrations. And I also remember seeing a stage version, which I was very taken with as a small child, and particularly by the figure of Ben Gunn, if you remember, who's this really weird figure who's been marooned on the island and is then obsessed by cheese. So I found him both fascinating and terrifying as a character. I suppose it's an adventure story, so it kind of does connect to the North Water in a weird way. I mean, there's a kind of, and it's about a voyage as well, so that's kind of intriguing how those two things did connect. It's just full of sort of wonderful stuff, you know, Long John Silver and Jim Hawkins in the barrel overhearing them conspiring and everything. And then I recently, during lockdown, I saw a National Theatre. The National Theatre had a stage version which you could sort of screen, which I thought was fantastic as well, which reminded me of how great it was. But it had a female Jim Hawkins, which brought it up to date.
Perhaps you were a sailor in a previous life.
Maybe, yeah, because I don't know how to sail, but I would love to be able to sail. So, yeah, there is something about the sea which appeals to me.
Next moment, we were both groping downstairs, leaving the candle by the empty chest. And the next, we'd opened the door and were in full retreat. We'd not started a moment too soon. The fog was rapidly dispersing. Already the moon shone quite clear on the high ground to either side. And it was only in the exact bottom of the dell and round the tavern door that a thin veil still hung unbroken to conceal the first steps of our escape. Far less than halfway to the hamlet, very little beyond the bottom of the hill, we must come forth into the moonlight. Nor was this all, for the sound of several footsteps, running, already came to our ears. And as we looked back in their direction, a light, tossing to and fro, and still rapidly advancing, showed that one of the newcomers carried a lantern. "My dear," said my mother suddenly, "take the money and run on. I'm going to faint." This was certainly the end for both of us, I thought. How I cursed the cowardice of the neighbours. How I blamed my poor mother for her honesty and her greed, for her past foolhardiness and present weakness. We were just at the little bridge by good fortune, and I helped her, tottering as she was, to the edge of the bank, where sure enough she gave a sigh and fell on my shoulder. I don't know how I found the strength to do it all, and I'm afraid it was roughly done, but I managed to drag her down the bank and a little way under the arch. Farther I could not move her, for the bridge was too low and let me do no more than crawl below it.
Treasure Island by Robert Stevenson and narrated by Gabriel Wolfe is available on the RNIB Talking Books Library.
What about a book then that you would like to curl up and reread on a rainy day? We've been having lots of them recently.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about this because it implies a cosy book and I don't like cosy books that much, so it was slightly harder. But the book actually I came up with, which is a book I did reread again over lockdown, as many people were rereading, is a book by the Irish short story writer and novelist John McGann, which probably is not that well known, but it's called That They May Face the Rising Sun. And it's a kind of amazing book, I think. One of the amazing things is that I think it's a book about happiness, which is very, very hard to write about because happiness is not very dramatically interesting. It's that Tolstoy's line, all happy families are the same. So I think it's very hard to write a novel about happiness, but I think John McGann does it in That They May Face the Rising Sun.
Unfortunately, That May Face the Rising Sun by John McGann is unavailable in audio. But here's a clip from his autobiography, Memoir, narrated by John Cormack.
My father would have seen it as a step down from the world of civil servants, teachers, doctors, nurses, policemen, tillage inspectors to which he belonged. Also, it was too close to where my mother's relatives lived and where I had grown up with my mother. The very name of the Ivy Leaf Ballroom would have earned his disapproval. A local man, Patsy Conboy, built it with money he made in America. He first called it Fenneville. It was the forerunner of the Cloudlands and the Roselands, and later it became, more appropriately, the Ivy Leaf. All through the 1950s and into the 1960s, he hired famous dance bands. In spite of being denounced from several pulpits, the ballroom prospered, and Patsy Conboy became a local hero, dispensing much employment. People came by bus, by lorry, hackney car, horse trap, on bicycle and on foot to dance the night away.
So have you got a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, it's Second Place by Rachel Cusk, which I think was published just, definitely this year, and it was longlisted for the Booker Prize. The central character, who's never named, the narrator, is a woman who owns a house with quite a lot of land on a coast. It's never said where the coast is. It seems to me a bit probably, it feels like it's New England. On the land, she has this other smaller house, which is the second place, which she invites writers and artists to live in. And the novel is about her experience of inviting one particular painter who she's become obsessed with his work. And when she invites him, she sort of fantasizes they're going to have some very important relationship, that something very important is going to happen. And then when he gets there, it proves that he's not at all interested in her, and he's very arrogant, and her advances are kind of spurned in various ways. And the novel is really about her thinking through what this means and trying to understand it. And it's quite a kind of intellectual, slightly philosophical novel, but really, really interesting. I mean, I think Rachel Cusk is one of the most interesting writers around at the moment, and maybe doesn't get as much attention as she deserves, because her previous three novels, which formed a trilogy, were all really, really brilliant. And this is slightly different, but equally interesting, I thought.
My husband, Tony, sometimes says to me that I underestimate my own power. And I wonder whether that makes living more hazardous for me than for other people. The way it's dangerous for those who lack the ability to feel pain. I've often thought that there are certain characters who can't or won't learn the lesson of life, and that they live among us as either a nuisance or a gift. What they cause can be called trouble, or it can be called change. The point is, though they may not mean to or want to, they make it happen. They're always stirring things up and objecting and upsetting the status quo. They won't just leave things be. They themselves are neither bad nor good. That's the important thing about them. But they know good from bad when they see it. Is this how the bad and the good continue to flourish alongside each other in our world, Jeffers? Because certain people won't let either one get the upper hand. That day on the train, I decided to pretend not to be one of them. Life looked so much easier all of a sudden. Over there, behind the books and newspapers people were holding up in front of their faces to hide the devil from their sight. What is certain is that afterwards many changes occurred, and I had to use all my strength and my belief in right and my capacity for pain to survive them.
Second Place by Rachel Cusk is available in audio commercially.
Three great choices there, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Ellie.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.